Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. We Americans love democracy, but hate politics. And that is likely a losing proposition. Interests with a major financial stake do play the political game, hiring lobbyists and giving big money to campaigns, while the rest of us are talking about it in the cafe. It can be hard to learn how the system really works, or it can be surprisingly easy. The best quick version, and the most interesting that I've run across in years, is a book called The Wicked Wine of Democracy. Its author is a longtime insider, political operative, and lobbyist, Joseph S. Miller of Washington, D.C. Joe, many thanks for joining us on Home Ground.
Thank you, Brian. It's a pleasure to be here.
What led to your involvement in politics?
I'd say the most immediate influence was being a newspaper man. One of my first newspaper jobs before I went in the Army in World War II was on the Lewiston Morning Tribune in Lewiston, Idaho. And my editor, A.L. Bud Alford, who was well-connected politically, put a memo in my typewriter one day that said that U.S. Senator D. Worth Clark was in town staying at the Lewiston Clark Hotel, and that I should go over and interview, as he put it, the son of a bitch, but don't write up any of it. Just find out what's on his mind. So I went over to the hotel, and D. Worth Clark was most generous with his time, and we had quite a long session. And I came back and told Alford about it, and he said, well, you better write it up. We better print it. That was my first encounter with a real live political figure.
You were already heavily engaged in the political process by the 1950s, and as your book makes clear, you knew some of the key players.
That's
I'm going
true.
To ask you to give a thumbnail sketch of several of them.
All right.
First, Jack Kennedy.
Well, I found Jack Kennedy, who I first was exposed to when he came to Seattle in 1947. I was picked to interview him for the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, and we had a very interesting, I'd say about an hour, and I was frankly completely captivated.
Why?
With him. His almost total candor. He had a jeweler's eye for the political process. By 1947, I was fascinated with and I was reading heavily biographies, and I was captivated by the idea of being involved in politics.
Okay.
As a newspaper man, and we just kind of had a wonderful time. We hit it off.
And later on, when he ran for president, you supported him. This is 12 years later, 59, right?
Yeah, well, 57, actually.
Okay.
Lyndon Johnson had sent me out to manage Bill Proxmire's campaign for the U.S. Senate. Joe McCarthy had died, and the governor set up a special election.
Okay.
And it happened that had Governor Kohler beaten Proxmire in the special election, Lyndon Johnson would have lost his majority leadership, and Bill Noland of California.
So it was a big deal.
It was a
big deal. So what was Kennedy's connection with it?
Well, we didn't have any money to professionally poll, but there were 10 congressional districts in Wisconsin, and young Democrats in all those districts. It showed that the Joe McCarthy vote, which was one-third of the total, was up for grabs, and that the only politician that would interest them was Jack Kennedy.
That's very interesting, the Joe McCarthy vote.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
It was.
Huh.
It was. And
so did you bring him out there?
Well, yes, and that's the story in itself.
We probably don't have time for the story in itself. He came out. You spent more time with him?
Yeah, absolutely. Not only that, but I saw his great potential for television. Hmm. We completed this 12, 14-hour day in Green Bay where the Catholic Brothers had WBAY, a television station that had just acquired taping equipment. So we taped some Kennedy spots. He did them off the cuff, And the timing was perfect. He was just a wonderful natural television performer. And there was about a week to go in the campaign, and all our television spots were concentrated in that week. I took Bill Proxmire off, and I just ran Jack Kennedy. And a Democrat hadn't been elected statewide in Wisconsin for 25 years. Proxmire beat Kohler, who had beat him twice for governor by as much as 450,000 votes. Proxmire won by about 130,000 votes. It was one of the great upsets of modern political history.
Well, that's obviously a huge victory. What did it do for your career?
Everything. The Washington Post profiled me with their top political writer, and they called me the Democrats' answer to Madison Avenue. Now, for a 35-year-old rookie into the game, you couldn't ask for anything more than that. And many other papers, the Louisville Courier-Journal, the Portland Oregonian, etc.
What was your relationship to Lyndon Johnson?
A very tenuous and edgy one. Johnson said many times over that unless he had a man's balls in his pocket, he didn't consider him one of his.
Yes.
And since I was being paid as campaign director of the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, I was on retainer from the United Steelworkers of America. And Johnson never had my balls in his pocket.
And so he didn't like you, didn't trust you?
He didn't like me or trust me.
In short, what work did you do with Johnson? Why did you interface with him politically?
Well, I felt that I owned him because Dick Neuberger's election, which I managed in Oregon, made him majority leader. Johnson majority leader by one vote. Frank Church's victory in Idaho in 56 preserved that margin by one vote. And Proxmire's election in the special election of 57 also preserved Johnson's majority leadership by one vote.
Okay, and you'd engineered those or been instrumental
in them. I'd engineered all three of them.
All right, so you felt you owned him and he felt he owned you. So how does that play out with Lyndon
Johnson?
Well,
I was the loser in it, but I figured I got at least a split decision. And I was fortunate in that Johnson's whip, Senator Earl Clements of Kentucky, kind of considered me a surrogate son. And he protected me on a number of my rash remarks or actions.
We are talking with the author of The Wicked Wine of Democracy, a memoir by Joe Miller. You say you got a split decision. What was the losing side for you?
It, with as powerful a majority leader as Johnson was, and a damn good one, it doesn't help to have people know that Johnson didn't look on me with total favor.
I remember reading in your book, you say he got you fired in your job after he became president.
After he became president.
So what happened?
Well, 10 days after he became president, I was fired by the United Steelworkers of America and the National Rural Electric Cooperative Association, my two major national clients. And Johnson did it.
You know that?
Oh, absolutely. Both McDonald told me, Dave McDonald, the president of the steelworkers, and Clyde Ellis told me, who was mm-hmm. the general manager of the National Rural Electric Co-op Association.
Now, before the fallout, how did you find him to work with compared with other politicians?
I didn't work with him. I worked with the whip, Earl Clements of Kentucky. And we were inseparable. And my only contact with Johnson was when he called me in and told me to go to Wisconsin to manage Proxmire's campaign. He said, we'll find out what kind of a hotshot you are, and if you don't win, keep going and go back to Seattle, or words to that effect.
Your book makes clear you knew Mike Mansfield well. What kind of guy was he?
Well, I have to say that in my 53 years in Washington, Mike Mansfield was the purest, finest, citizen politician I have ever known. I worship the man because he was so incredibly honest. And incidentally, the book of Mike Mansfield's, authored by Don Oberdorfer, foreign correspondent of the Washington Post, is a great, great book in my judgment that received virtually no attention.
You say you admired him that much, why? What? That's pretty high praise for the hardball world of politics.
Because I will say he was everything Lyndon Johnson was not. I thought he was a great majority leader, a great ambassador to Japan, and the most marvelously, genuinely humble person that I ever encountered.
Let me ask you this. Politics, from reading your book, is very largely driven by short-term specific legislative questions, provisions in bills, lobbyists coming in like yourself saying, we need this, we need that.
True.
And at the same time, there's this concept of the broader public interest being protected over time. And you yourself comment that you wanted to believe, often you say in an illusory way, that you were working for some greater good.
Correct.
Now, as far as Mansfield, how do you see him at that? Was he just great at working legislation, taking care of his constituents? Did he have a bigger vision? How would you characterize him in that respect?
That is a tough question, and I don't know if I can really answer it decently. But I would say that Mike had the interests of the average Montanan in his heart and soul, and just had this a marvelous capacity to convey this to the average person. Mike didn't have to. He, with the exception of the Ecton campaign in 1952, Mike, all he had to do to get elected in Montana was just pay the filing fee and visit with the folks, which his method of campaigning was marvelous. He and his local sidekick, they just bum around the state and set up shop in a tavern, whether it was Terry or Glendive or wherever. Everybody knew Mike was in town, and they all flooded in to see him. And sometimes they got a drink, sometimes they didn't. But that was Mike's campaigning.
Okay, now that goes back to the question of his ability to connect with local Montanans in a very comfortable way. You commented on his personal qualities when you discussed who he was, his honesty, his humility. My specific question was his political approach. You said he had the interests of everyday Montanans in his heart.
Absolutely.
And I asked you if he had a broader picture as well, and I want to raise specifically, I interviewed him perhaps the last time in his life. He was in his middle 90s, and he talked about the Vietnam War.
Absolutely.
Now, that struck me as not just driven his opposition to the war, not just driven by local political considerations. Fair?
Absolutely.
So then that would suggest a part of his political...
That was his passion. As majority leader, his main thrust, it totally runs through Oberdorfer's book, Mike's passionate desire was to keep us out of Vietnam. At the age of 14, he was in the Marine Corps in Shenzhen, China, about 1919, I think. His whole early life was absorbed with the history of the Far East. When he came back and went to work in the mines in Butte, his bride-to-be, a schoolteacher, Maureen, she got him to go to the University of Montana, where they had one of the best Far Eastern programs in public academia, and Mike became a professor of Far Eastern history at the University of Montana. And in any respect, it was his field, and he made himself an expert on it, and and he knew Johnson was totally, completely ignorant about the politics of Vietnam or Asian affairs.
And he eventually broke with LBJ publicly about it.
Well, finally.
Yeah, not initially then.
Mike was not a person to be majority leader of a party and create a public feud with the president of his own party. Uh-huh. But Mike's memos, his appeals to Johnson, his everything were about as passionate as any political figure would ever write, I think.
We are talking with Joe Miller, author of the, for me, fascinating book, The Wicked Wine of Democracy. You mentioned that Mike Mansfield was a very humble man. In your book, you write a lot about people who weren't humble, who had big egos, including you. And you wrote about it very candidly. What's the role of ego in politics? Is it any different than in everyday life?
I think it is. I think it's more accentuated. And I think it's practically everything. I can't see people subjecting themselves to what they subject themselves to in the political process without having huge, oversized egos.
Okay. In your case, as a lobbyist and political operative, did having that big ego, fueled by your successes, help your work over time, hinder your work over time, or both?
It was deadly. It was deadly. When I was victimized in the political process, it was largely due to my own ego that grew out of bounds after the Washington Post profiled me in 1957 and called me the Democrats' answer to Madison Avenue.
That made you feel pretty big.
That made me the almost as arrogant a son of a bitch as Lyndon Johnson was.
He just ended up as president.
Yeah.
How does that affect, if at all, people's focus on, in the words of the preamble to the Constitution, to promote the general welfare? It's one of the core charges in the preamble.
Well,
does it affect people's perception of what the general welfare is? Do they lose sight of it, or are they able to keep track of it?
That's a kind of an abstraction, but politicians succeed by promising people what they want. And the good politician knows how to promise people what they want. That's why he gets elected.
So ego wouldn't interfere with that?
No, but ego is the driving force.
Okay.
You know, why does a man go through what politicians go through without ego?
All right, let's go back to the public welfare, promoting the general welfare. You say politicians are good at giving people what they want. We just recently interviewed the communications director for the Center for Responsive Politics that tracks money in politics. And your book, The Wicked Wine of Democracy, The Wicked Wine is Money.
Right.
Now, from reading your book, it seems to me most of the people that politicians give what they want to are people who come to talk to them, lobbyists, about very specific provisions in very specific legislation. Is that a fair assessment?
So there's a symbiotic relationship between the politician and the lobbyist that will never be broken. And it's probably one of the most significant things in the whole relationship that the politician has with his constituency.
Someone might say that cumulatively, the collection of lobbyists lobbying for very specific issues in specific bills, usually for profitability for their business or their union or whatever, in total, that does represent the public interest. So there's no problem. Someone else might look at the same situation and say, no, those even in total represent a narrow spectrum of the public interest, and the average working person, middle-class person out there, is not at the table, and so they don't get from the politician what they want other than platitudes. In other words, it's a two-level game. What would you say to that?
Well, what I would say to that, it depends on the constituency a person represents. If it's a significant enough constituency, he doesn't need to give the guy a nickel. because he controls a block of votes that the politician needs.
Meaning the constituent doesn't need to give any money to the politician,
right,
because he controls votes. That suggests it's votes or money.
Yeah.
Okay, but let's continue to explore this. Then that suggests that the symbiotic relationship, if you're the politician, you're going to deal with people carefully who give you a lot of money.
Right.
Or can deliver a lot of votes.
Right.
Okay, so now there's a whole segment of the community out there that is not organized, that's just out there, regular people,
right,
doing their job. Would you agree or disagree, based on your experience, that that broad public and any general interests they may share, like, let's say, in good education, affordable health care, to pick just two, that those don't get the same kind of attention because they're disorganized? They don't have lobbyists representing them with money or organized votes. Fair or not fair?
Fair to a degree. The whole electorate has become so organized in my own time, which is roughly 50-some years, and in an active role in the process. I'm 88 years old. And there are very few unorganized portions of the electorate really left. It used to be women were a great target among the unorganized, but since the feminine revolution, et cetera, and et cetera, the women, which represent 53% of the total vote, they're as well organized as any group in the country.
Would you say, for example, that non-union laborers, I just saw some data in the New York Times that now in the United States, only 7% of the workforce, private sector workforce, is represented by unions.
True.
93% is not. Would you say the 93% is well represented by lobbyists in Congress?
They're represented inferentially.
Okay. How is that?
Well, it's not an easy question to answer. In fact, it may be unanswerable. But if you're an unorganized machinist, an unorganized steelworker, or whatever.
Retail clerk, you name
retail
it.
Retail clerk. You're not going to be ignored. Politicians are not going to ignore you.
Let me ask you finally the area of money, and I know it's a big subject. Two questions. One, do you feel that its influence in political campaigns, on balance, helps represent the broad public interest or not?
Hell no.
Okay.
Hell no. The fact is that in today's political world, politicians spend, I can't give you the percentage, but I would say up to 90% of their time raising money. Hmm. I mean, it's a never-ending process.
Okay, so they spend a lot of time raising money, and I'm jumping in because I'm watching the clock, Joe, and I apologize.
Okay.
We're going to run out of time. Is it the problem they spend that much time, or is it the problem that there's strings on the money that prevent the politician from taking a broad look at the public interest?
Nobody can, as Earl Long of Louisiana used to say, the people that the folks that contributed before the primary, they're going to get what they want. The ones that contributed after are going to get good government. That sort of sums it up, I think.
And was that your experience in your decades in political work?
Hell yes.
In your book, you're not very optimistic about the ability to get money out of politics, and you point out that McCain-Feingold and I think the earlier Burton reform really didn't change
their
things.
They're fiascos. McCain-Feingold didn't stop 1 cent from entering the political process. It just made it a little trickier, but as George Will, who I don't often agree with, or I sometimes agree with, George Will has written extensively of what a fiasco it turned out to be.
Okay, let me ask you a final question. If money does not have a constructive democratic influence in politics, and we can't seem to get rid of it, are you an optimist or a pessimist about the future of our particular democracy, and why?
I think it's still an open question. I think it is still an open question. We are still, after 230 years, we're still democracy, American style, is still a work in progress. We started with a great document called the Declaration of Independence, which if we've half fulfilled it, I'd be surprised.
Okay.
The Constitution turned out to be a much more realistic document, but it's not a democratic document.
Okay, but the goals were set in the Declaration. You say we fulfilled them partway, maybe half. So when it's all said and done after your decades of work in politics and everything we've discussed here and everything you put in your book, are you an optimist or a pessimist, and why, about the future of American democracy?
Well, I was born an optimist. My mother said that from the time she first saw me, that I had a big smile on my face, and that when she wheeled me around Lower Manhattan in a baby carriage, people would stop and just stare at me because I was such a happy little kid. And it's in my genes. I don't think you can be in American politics as a pessimist. I think optimism is a sine qua non of being successful in the game. These Tea Partiers and some kind of crackpots, the people that are looking down on American democracy, serve a purpose, but not expanding the game or contributing anything but negativism. You got to be an optimist.
You're still smiling at 88, Joe.
I'm still smiling.
Joe Miller, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us on Homegrown.
Well, I enjoyed it, Brian, and thank you very much for having me as guest say on television.
To our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is a production of Artemis Common Ground, which is solely responsible for the views expressed. Carmen Mowbray is our producer. Contact us at P.O. Box 748, Helena, Montana, 59624, or visit us on the web at homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, High Stakes, Norcross Wildlife Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communications about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.